introduce
You're doing a
Rudolph.
great job, Bruce.
We'll introduce Elon Adler at 9:01 on a Thursday morning, zipping along with Zoom with the fraught English Colo here on Tiny Duster. And we'll have Elon elucidate with eye-catching shuvot.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Appreciate it. And thank you, Avi and Justin, and God willing, all those who will be joining us whenever they can. So today we're going to look at Inyana Diyoma, which has nothing to do with Purim, nothing to do with Yom Kippur anyway. See how easy it is to mix them up, Purim, Yom Kippurim, as our sages have done very often and effectively with all their drushes about how similar they are. So today we have a few questions that we're going to look at
Just to make a
regarding.
mention quickly for the guys online, the last minute, Marty Feder agreed to give us a Thursday night shot on Purim talk. It'll be at 7:30 tonight. I imagine people have eaten something by that time, so that's going to be the night program. 7:30 with Marty Feder, shot on Purim. Okay, back to you,
Wonderful.
Avinash.
Good, good, good. Very nice. Morning, Irving. Nice to see you again. Well, almost see you. So today we're going to look at some questions that relate to Purim. I found them all very eye-catching, interesting. And again, I like to say this often, that what's eye-catching to me is the range of opinions about any one thing that we accept as this is the psak and this is the halacha. And we do have Piskei Halacha, from contemporary Poskim and Gedolim, etc. At the same time, there's also a wide variety of opinions that have been offered about any one thing. So that, to me, still is novel, even after all these years. Has it been almost 5 years? I think September will be 5 years that I've been teaching. Because
Wow, time.
we
Time
came to
is.
Efrat in 2019.
Wow. We have a, there's a pension you can apply for to
Oh, wonderful. Good. I can use 12 shekels a year, because you never know. You just never know.
when you go
Anyway.
67, you apply to Bituach Lumi here.
Oh, I've been getting it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yes. That and Social Security. Thank God. Thank God I can get my money back through Social Security. In any case, yeah, even though this Kollel gig, provides me with all the financial security I'll ever need, there's still, thank God, other sources of income. Anyway, we all do it with great pleasure. And well, I think I can speak everybody, all of us who are teaching in the Kollel, we find great pleasure in the preparation and the people getting together, teaching, learning from each other. So that's all good. Okay, so let's take our first look at the idea of Parshat Zachor, Shabbat Zachor, God willing, this coming Shabbat. And we are going to be reading Devarim Chaf Hei Yud Zayin through Yud Tet. This is a reminder towards the end of the book of Devarim, the reminder to remember the nefarious deeds of Amalek as we left Egypt. Asher Karcha Baderech, they came and they attacked you from behind. Karcha has a lot of various meanings. They cooled you off. I don't know if that was Rashi or somebody else. They cooled you off as you came out hot and protected and defended well by Hashem. And they attacked you. Zachor al tishkach. Remember what they did and don't forget it. Don't forget it. So the commentaries remind us that in these three verses that we'll be reading on Shabbat Zachor, we find three mitzvot that are connected to Amalek. One is to wipe out the line of Amalek, which I think we're pretty familiar with the idea that we're not all sitting here vigilantes with guns and rifles and grenades, and we're not that concerned about who is a genetic Amalek descendant. If we follow the opinion of Rav Soloveitchik and others, anybody who is out to kill Jews and they say it, and they state it very, very clearly, there you go. You get the Amalek crown of the day. So Three things. We have to wipe out the line of Amalek. We'll talk more about that. We have to remember what they did to us. We'll talk more about that. And we have to not forget the evil that they did to us. And we'll talk more about that. So a few interesting questions arise from these three psukim. The Gemara in Megillah says that remembering is both verbal and in one's heart, which is what it says in that last pasuk, Zachor al Tishkach. It says it, we have to do it verbally, and we have to keep it in our heart that this is a goal of ours, and we have to reinforce that by reading Parshat Zachor on Shabbat Zachor. And so by reading this, these three psukim, we fulfill the idea b'peh, because somebody is actually reading it out loud for us. And by doing that, it also enters the heart. That which we hear by our ears also has a way of penetrating into the heart, reminding us of our obligation regarding Amalek. Ramban. The Ramban says we should remember verbally, but it's not limited to a specific text. That's interesting. He says we can tell our children and our families the story of what they did to us, and that is sufficient. We don't have to read that text. We don't have to read the text in Shemot, where we read exactly what happened live at that time in Shemot. An interesting question could arise. If you're not going to be limited to that text at the end of Devarim, can you fulfill this De'oraita requirement by reading or telling the stories of other Amaleks? In other words, you know, you have a series of Holocaust survivors, let's say. You have a series of hostage survivors. Can that qualify as the stories of Amalek? Or does it have to be Dafka stories of Amalek? Or can they be pseudo Amalek? I don't have an answer for that, but I think that's an interesting question that would arise from the position of the Ramban. Rambam, he also alludes to this idea, namely, that the main idea is to recount what happened in order to arouse hatred against Amalek. And so Zachor means to retell in order to remind each other to despise Amalek and to eradicate them. So it's not some benign hearing or telling that can be done dispassionately, but it has to be something that's done with a certain level of, I'll use the word passion, so that it arouses feelings within the ones who hear it. So whether you read it with a text or you tell the story, it's not to be done kelachar yad. It's not just to be done to dispense a de'oraita obligation. You ought to mean it, etc.
When they say to talk about others, the idea is to get over the misconception, so to speak, to wake up to reality wherever it's necessary, where evil exists.
I would say that's a good way to put it. Yeah, don't be lulled. Don't be lulled and don't think, they were just kidding. They don't really mean that. You know, it's the terrible part of them that makes them say that. They
no,
only
no, of
say
course.
That.
It's when we say they have a justification. They might very well.
Oh.
But we have our own story and our own narrative, and that's what's important.
Well, so last night there was a program at the Begin Center with Gil Hoffman, who is now the head of Honest Reporting, and Alon Levy, a government spokesman who was suspended, not let go, but he was suspended. Anyway, the two of them were on a program last night at the Begin Center. My wife and I went. And during the Q&A, somebody says to him, do you sometimes feel like you're preaching to the choir? Like when you talk to Jewish audiences, like, you know, most of the people here tonight at the Begin Center probably are Jewish. Do you sometimes feel like you're preaching to the choir? And he said, very astute, he said, you know, in our days, even the choir needs to be preached to so they know what to sing. I think he said it very well. You know, there's all kinds of videos going around of Jewish people senators and others, people who get Oscars, all kinds of Jewish people that really need to be preached to, and they're so-called in the choir, but they're not singing the same tune as many of us are. So again, I'm not sure if the Ramban would say that in order to fulfill this mitzvah, you can tell the story of any Amalek or specifically Amalek from the Torah or not. But again, the idea is to arouse. It should arouse feelings, bepeh, and in the lev, feelings of not being comfortable and knowing that the Amalek can sprout up at any time, which is a very unfortunate thing. We'll get to Rav Soloveitchik's take on all of this. And I took it from his Chumash. There's a 5-volume Rav Soloveitchik set of Chumashim where he talks about this, and he is spot on in what he says, but with Bezrat Hashem, we'll get to it. So the Tosfot and the Rosh, they say that no, it's not up to us as to what story we tell. We need to read the 3 psukim that are the Takana. This is what the sages have told us to read on Shabbat Zohar, the 3 psukim at the end of Ki Teitze. Now, Rav Rimon quotes many achronim who say that it should be a text, since in Shmot it speaks of Ketov Zot Zikaron B'Sefer. You should write in a book. So, according to the achronim, it should something come from a text. Which text, you know, could be up for grabs, but it's just not a free telling story, as much as it needs to be grounded in something textual from the Torah. And some say, if the point of it is zechira balev, that in your heart it should be affirmed and reconfirmed about what is our obligation to rid ourselves of Amalek. Any way you verbalize this episode will enter the heart. Whether it's a text, it's a retelling, it'll awaken, it'll reinforce our duty to imitate Amalek. So let's see how other poskim deal with this. Mishnah Brura, Ovadia Yosef, Mordechai Eliyahu. These are relatively contemporary voices. They say you're Yotze only with the text in Devarim. There's the one in Shmot, you can tell stories. But you have not yet fulfilled your obligation, except with those 3 psukim at the end of Ki Teitze. The Magen Avraham, he says you may read the psukim in Shmot, Yud Zayin, Chet through Ted Zayin, as the text, and you can be Yotze with that. This is what's read on Purim. And the Magen Avraham says, if you didn't hear Zachor on Shabbat, couldn't make it to Shul, whatever the story is, you can be Yotze with this mitzvah de'oraita with the Purim reading that we have from Shmot. So you didn't hear it on Shabbat? You can be Yotze that obligation by hearing the Purim reading in Shul. A question about this. Must Zachor be read from a Torah? Okay, you've convinced me, right? You've twisted my arm. You've convinced me that it ought to be those 3 psukim from the end of Ki Teitze. Does it have to be from a Torah? And the answer is, yes, it should be from a Kriya B'Sefer, and it should be from a valid Torah. Something that's not pasul in general. The Pri Megadim says only a kosher Torah, otherwise you are not Yotze. You read from a pasul.
Why do you think that's the case?
Why do I think that would be the case?
Yeah.
Well, for example,
in a place where there is no Torah scroll, you just have a Tanakh, you have a book. I mean, why do you think you need a kosher Torah scroll?
Yeah, so we will see surely that others say if all you have is a book, then that's what you use in your Yotze. The preference is to read it B'Sefer. That's the preference. Interestingly enough, the Maharam Shik, who used to shave, he says B'Sefer means from something written to exclude an oral retelling, as we were saying before. And the Maharam Shik says it can be read from a Pasul Torah, and it can even be read from a Chumash. That's interesting. But however, you must, if you're going to read it in the shul, even from Apostle Torah, you must have a minyan. Why? Because the mitzvah of mechiyat Amalek, to erase them and get rid of them, is on the tzibur. It's on the tzibur. It's not just my obligation. It's not a personal obligation to get rid of Amalek, but this is a tziburi, a public obligation for them. And some would say, therefore, women are not included in this mitzvah of having to hear about it, because the women are not part of the tzibur that needs to eradicate and eliminate Amalek. There are many other opinions about women and having to go to hear this. Most say, yes, women are obligated, and they do fulfill the mitzvah of the Oraita if they go on Shabbat Zohar and hear it.
It's
the mission
interesting, isn't it, a question where we break it into gender issues? I mean,
always.
I'm not sure today that would pop out at us as a question, like,
you're right,
are women included or men included? We just are people.
Yeah, I would say that too. Yeah, so sometimes it's surprising how the gender issue comes up. The Mishnah Berurah Ovadia Yosef said you can also read it b'yichidut. You can read it on your own if that's the situation. Nevertheless, they say there's a takanat chachamim to read it in public, and so we follow that. Can you read it by yourself? Yes. Preference, the takanat chachamim, is to read it in public, to read it, if possible, from a kosher Torah. What about a minyan? You're in shul. You're going to read it from a Torah. Do you need a minyan? Let's say there is no minyan, so you take out a Torah and you read it from there. Are you yotze? So if there is no minyan, you should read it from the Torah with trup, or even a chumash with trup, while at the same time you should have a kavana to be yotze, your obligation, with ki teitze, that maybe you'll hear later in the day, or even with Purim's reading. So you see that there's a kind of hierarchy as the best way to fulfill it, kind of bidyeved's way to fulfill it, but in any case, and there seem to be many ways to fulfill it, many, many different readings to fulfill it. So that to me was very eye-opening, how many different ways there are, and again, the spread of opinions about this idea of Shabbat Zohar, what's read, and from what it is read. Okay, so we'll continue on to the next question. Does the reading of Zohar, this again at the end of Ki Teitze, does it need a kavana lehotzi? In other words, the Torah reader, when they're reading those three psukim, do they need to have in mind lehotzi everyone else, that they are now reading to help the others fulfill the obligation of Zohar? And do the people in the shul need a kavana latzeit? Do they need to have a special kavana that their obligation is now being done through this reading? And the Mishnah Berurah says, yes, yes, both. Both. The reader has to have a kavana lahotzi, and the people have to have a kavana latzeit. And so the custom in many places, even the Chatam Sofer says this, that the custom was to announce that all should have kavana. Everybody should have kavana. What I don't remember from year to year is whether people sit or stand when this is read. Does anybody remember in your own shuls? Does anybody say, please rise? Do people rise? Do people sit? I don't remember from year to year.
Yeah. Huh, I don't remember. Avi Pfeiffer will know. Alex knows. Alex, do we sit or stand for this?
That's our minhag, not to remember.
I see. Did you have a kavana not to remember? Wow. Yes, I don't know. I don't remember, but
we
I guess
we don't announce it. But most people stand. But some say we don't. It's not announced.
Avi, you say most people do stand?
Yeah.
It could be. It's a d'oraita. You know, maybe people feel compelled to be propelled. I don't know. I guess everybody will see when they get to it this Shabbat. God willing, we should all be able to go and fulfill the mitzvah. Next question. We just touched upon it. Are women commanded in Parshat Zachor? Sefer Achinuch. No, he says just men. It's really for them to do the war against Amalek. This is a male mitzvah, and therefore women are not commanded to hear this parsha of Zachor. The Minchat Chinuch, commentary on the Sefer HaChinuch, says no, women are obligated. Absolutely. The Rambam, women obligated. Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly. That's what the Rambam says, because it's a Milchemet Mitzvah to get rid of Amalek. Women too are obligated. It's not as Zman Grama, which is interesting to even mention it. But it comes into play because the question that we'll look at also this morning is how often do you have to remember it? How often? Daily? Once a year? A few times a year? If it's once a day, one could interpret it as a Zman Grama. One could. I'm not saying one should, or it's easy to do that. Anyway, most rule that yes, women should come. Women are invited. Women, there are often extra readings of Shabbat Zachor, so that they may say that this Shabbat, the following schedule is for those that couldn't make it to the minyan, the regular minyan. There'll be one at 11, another one at 11:15, 11:30. There'll be another reading of Zachor right before Mincha today. So that's to encourage everybody to come. And though nobody mentioned it in everything I looked at, I would say that includes kids. I would say that I didn't see kids anywhere in my looking at various Piskei Halacha for today. But certainly I think kids who understand a little bit of what it is should also be brought. Now the Chazon Ish, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, they say no, women are not obligated. They're not obligated, but I think in most shuls there is this sense, whether it's in the weekly email, weekly bulletin, whatever it is, I think most shuls do obligate the women and encourage them to come and to listen. There's an interesting question that Rav Rimon mentioned in his one volume on Purim. I don't know if you have it. I found it extremely excellent. Rav Rimon, I don't know. I always mention when I mention, I don't know where he finds the time to do everything he does. And now he's also involved in the running of Mizrahi, the Mizrahi organization. I don't remember his new title, but unfortunately we heard of the murder of Daniel Peretz a few days ago, whose family, like all of the others, are waiting for their loved ones to come home. And they found out that he was murdered on the 7th. He was abducted and murdered on October the 7th. So Hashem Yikom Damo, as well as all the others. An interesting question. May a Katan do the Haftorah for the four Parshiot? So Zachor is the next one. Then we have Parah. Then we have Chodesh and Shkalim and all that. Can a Katan do the Haftorah for the four Parshiot? So on a regular Shabbat, this is what Rav Rimon mentions, on a regular Shabbat, the Shulchan Aruch permits a Katan to have an Aliyah. Not even the Mafta, any. I don't go that often to Sephardi shuls, but I don't know that I've seen a minor be called for any of the aliyot of the Torah. The Mishnah Berurah says that lema'aseh, practically, we only give him maftir. That's the Mishnah Berurah. We only give him maftir. But the Rabbeinu Tam says, for a maftir connected to a Yom Tov or the four parshiot, we don't call a katan. Others say yes. The Maharil is wondering about Zachor, since Zachor is a deoraita, should you really call a katan for Parshat Zachor? The Rama, says you may call even on Shabbat Zachor. Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, he says you may call a katan if we do it all year, but we should be more machmir with Zachor. Now, in the various shuls that that all of us here today, this morning, attend, is it a custom in your shul, wherever that is, to call a pre-bar mitzvah for Aliyot or a Haftarah? Anybody witness that, do that?
I don't think we had any kids there anyway, so it's hard to know, but I don't think so.
Well, I've never seen.
Why would one do that?
I don't know. But that took up a couple of pages in Rav Rimon's books. This is I guess it's come up. Why would a shul do that? I don't know. It could be the father or mother's yahrzeit, and he's the oldest one in the family. He wants to do it to honor them. I don't know, but it's interesting. Ovadi Yosef, he says you may call a katan for shkalim and a chodesh, but not zachor or para, as both are midioraita. That parshat para, according to Ovadi Yosef, is also midioraita. Rabbi Akiva Eger, he is opposed to this. No katan for the four parshiot. However, if a katan has been called, we don't rescind it. The gabbai, whatever, called the katan is up there. It's ready to do the aliyah. And in most shuls, the decorum would, somebody would say, hey, how come he's up there? He's not even bar mitzvah yet. So that wouldn't happen in every shul, because in most shuls, the decorum is very refined and people don't just yell things out. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice if that was the case? Anyway, so Rabbi Akiva Eger, no katan for the four parshiot. If he was called, for whatever reason, we don't remove him. Let him do it, and that's it. Now we're going to take a very brief look, because this is probably a topic that you've heard about and studied or whatever. This question of Zecher Amalek or Zecher Amalek. So I remember, Bruce, a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about OCD. Here could be one. How do you pronounce it? Zecher Amalek, Zecher Amalek. Does it really make a difference?
Well, this is clearly an OCD case.
What's the difference in the words?
That's a good question. What's the difference? Some say that the difference is maybe present tense versus not a present tense. I remember hearing that, but I'm not exactly sure. Maybe one pronunciation means it's a current and continuing obligation, while the other pronunciation doesn't indicate that. More than that, I'm not sure I can say. But this is an issue. This is everything I looked at in terms of, you know, Hilchot Parshat Zachor, they all mention it.
Maybe, just maybe, it has to do with the males of Amalek.
Oh, because it could also be read Zachar.
Mm-hmm.
Zachar. I remember reading that in one work, that Zachar, Zachar Amalek or something like that, where it could be misinterpreted as referring only to the males. Okay, so either Zecher or Zecher should take care of that, that it's not referring to males, but it's referring to the memory of. So now why do we have two separate versions? Yeah. Okay, so since many of the poskim say, since the reading of Zachor fulfills the Deoraita, we really should be precise. The question is, what is the precise? So the Radak says there are two ways to read it. We read it in the Pasuk at the end of Ki Teitze as Zecher, Zecher. But let's say for beginning Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit LeDavid, we also have Zayin Chaf Resh, and there he says it's V'hodu LeZecher Kodesho. You also have this in Ashrei, Zecher Rav Tuvcha Yabiyu, Zecher Rav Tuvcha. Yep, you have that issue there too. So the Radak says practically, one time you should say Zecher, and that's enough. It's enough. Mishnah Berurah says you should read Zecher and then repeat it with Zecher. Question is, how much do you repeat? Repeat the entire Pasuk or just repeat the phrase Timche et Zecher Amalek? You read it first Zecher and then Zecher. Others say the other way around. Reb Moshe Feinstein, he says no need to repeat the entire Pasuk. Just repeat it by saying Timche et, whatever you didn't say, now say the other one. Zecher, Zecher. Just repeat that particular phrase.
Maybe stick in the English phrase so there's no ambiguity.
Oh, remember the nefarious deeds of Amalek? Lo tishka.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good one. I'm not going to go into this, but I saw somebody had posted an article about this opinion of the Radak, who says, yeah, you should read it both ways, one way this way, then the Zecher first and then Zecher. He wrote a whole article about how this idea of repeating it began about 100 years ago, and the controversy was based on a statement of the Radak, who died at 1235, and subsequent erroneous printings of what he wrote. So this goes back and forth, the Aleppo Codex, I don't know enough about it. In any case, the students of the Vilna Gaon read it both ways, as it was unclear which way the Vilna Gaon actually read it. The Mishnah Berurah says to us, read it both ways. And I don't recall if he said it, read it first this way and then that way. Okay. So just to know that it's a question, it's an issue. Anybody remember what happens in your shuls? Whether the Baal Kol Reh repeats it, repeats the whole thing, repeats the thing.
They repeat the whole thing. Why don't we do this for anything like Zecher Tzion Mitzrayim?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, why is this up for grabs and the other one seem to be so carved in stone, so to speak? Yeah. Not one source that I looked at mentioned that point. Like, why all of a sudden? Why all of a sudden? So, you know, Zecher Mitzrayim is also, that could easily be considered a deoraita. That, boom, comes from the Torah. Remember, daily, we remember it several times a day. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Why this one are we making a to-do, so to speak? Okay. May women count for a minyan in the Megillah? Now, Rav Rimon mentions this question, and I don't know what I expected as his response. May women be counted for the minyan? If you need a minyan for the Megillah, may women be counted? So he answers, if we need Pirsume Nisa and a tzibur through which to publicize this commandment to eradicate Amalek, question is, who can be part of this needed tzibur? What makes up this tzibur, which is needed through which to publicize this need to eradicate Amalek? Who is the tzibur? Is it only bar mitzvah age? Can the whole minyan be five adults and five minors? Maybe it's anyone or everyone can count for a minyan. Who makes up that minyan? Who can? Now, again, why we should think that all of a sudden women can be counted as part of the minyan for this particular, for Megillah, I'm not really sure. But that's a question that was raised. The Rama, he says we have a suffix about women being included for a minyan. That's interesting. A suffix. That already indicates that the Rama may have felt that there's reason to say they should be included, but we're not sure. The Prima Gadim says, quote, Kevan shenashim chayavot bekriyat ha-Megillah, since they are also obligated to hear the Megillah, barur sheminyan shel eser nashim nechshav keminyan le'inyan kriyat ha-Megillah. Since they are also obligated to hear the Megillah, it's clear that a minyan 10 women is considered a minyan. Now, he hasn't really answered our question. Our question is, can you mix men and women to create this minyan that's needed to hear the Megillah? So he says 10 women would create a minyan, and that would be a valid concept there for the women. There are many women's Megillah readings by women, for women. But the question is, can they be a mixed crowd? That's what we're asking. Can they be accounted with the men to create a minyan? So lemaisa, as they say, we don't include men and women together. That's the bottom line, says Rev. Rimon. We don't do that. And period. Full stop, period. We don't do that. let's move on a little bit to Mishloach Manot. What is the status of Mishloach Manot that are sent before Purim? This is an issue that can come up very, very easily. You're not going to be around on Purim. You have several Mishloach Manot to give. Nice packages, beautiful, costly, good stuff. But you're not going to be around on Purim, so I'll give it tomorrow. I'll go around to the people, give it tomorrow. This is for Purim. Please don't open it up until Purim. What's the status of having, have you achieved, performed the mitzvah of?
Run it through a shaliach.
Okay, you could do it through a shaliach on Sunday. Absolutely. You didn't, you couldn't, you didn't know who to call, the three people you wanted, they weren't around. So what happens if, lesof ma'aseh, you were not able to arrange for the giving of it on Purim. So,
or you gave it and left it at their door, but they in fact weren't home.
So that's incorrect.
They never got it till the next day, but
that's correct.
The property collected for them, so to speak.
Right, right. You left it there and cats and dogs ate it outside the door.
Was they just got it the next day. They got it afterwards.
Yeah. So, right. So what's the status of all that? Have you fulfilled the mitzvah by dropping it off? Often you go to deliver Mishloach Manot and often you see many outside the door and you add yours. So what is the status of Mishloach Manot either sent before Pesach or perhaps not received on Pesach? So there's another issue, another question Rav Rimon takes up.
Not Pesach.
Did I say Pesach?
You did.
I'm sorry. Didn't mean it.
Okay.
Yeah, didn't mean it. Didn't mean it. By the way, is today the first day of spring? Is this official? March 21? Don't all the new seasons come in on 21? March 21, June 21, September 21? No?
Yeah, it is March 21.
So today's the first official day of spring? I think so. Anyway, if it is, it makes my heart flutter.
Depends on your minute. Depends on your minute.
Right, right. It depends on the weather. Okay, so there's the question, the status of Mishloach Manot sent before Purim, received after Purim. So the question revolves around the idea of when should Mishloach Manot be given. So the Rosh. Rosh says, during the daytime, you don't give it at night. I remember one time when our kids were very small, we couldn't do it on the day. We delivered it at night, and the Rosh would not have been happy. The Ramah says the same. Nope, not during at night. This is a daytime mitzvah. And he matches with the Trumat HaDeshen, who says Mishloach Manot is to enhance the Seuda, which is daytime. Why is it a daytime minhag, a daytime mitzvah? Because it's connected to the Seuda, which is a daytime ritual. The Gra, Vilna Gaon, daytime, no question. Why? It says in the Megillah, these are Yemei Mishte V'Simcha. These are days of feasting and gladness. U'Mishloach Manot. These are days of. So you and I would say, yeah, it's a day of. But the Gra would say, no, it means day of. And therefore you deliver it and your Yotzei on the day, not at night.
Everything is more important by day. There's nothing at night that's more important.
Except like the Seder.
Well, I mean, in Purim.
On Purim, yeah. Ah, we're going to get to this question of which is the more important reading, the nighttime?
Well, sure, the day. Yeshua ben Levi added the nighttime one. He wanted to make sure that women and children who might miss the morning get to hear it at night. But you might say, if you had surgery scheduled early in the morning of that day of Purim, could you do everything during the night of that's a halachic day? Could you have your suit at night, deliver, do all things you need to do here in Megillah, since typically a day starts with nightfall? And again, b'diavad, I mean, you can't, you're not available during the day. You're going to be under anesthesia. Would you be b'diavad yotze if you did everything in the evening time?
So I don't know. Here's what I can tell you. With everything I looked at, no one said if you have to do it at night, it's better not to do it at all. I did not see that opinion. I didn't particularly see the opinion that if you can't do any of it during the day, yes, do it at night. I can't say I saw that. At the same time, I nobody said, and if you can only do it at night, better not to do it. It's valueless to do it. I didn't read that.
Well, there's nothing wrong, you know. You're hearing a Megillah, you're having a meal. There's no aveira involved in any of these things. So
right.
You can just do them at night anyway. I mean, it didn't hurt in any way.
Can't hurt. Yeah.
Can't hurt. Can't hurt.
Yeah. So if you ask me, if a congregant asks me, I can't do any of these things during the day because of, I would say, whatever you can do at night, gig isn't to hate.
And we know that the Gemara itself talks about 11 through, what is it, the 11th through 15th? I mean, very flexible dates on hearing Megillah to accommodate to make sure that people need to hear it when they can hear it.
Right.
It's not just one day or the other.
Right. It accommodates the different realities.
Yeah. The flexibility is only on reading the Megillah, not on the rest of the stuff, I think.
No, it is only the Megillah. You couldn't do anything on any other time, again, because you're going in for surgery. So you just did them anyway.
That's an onus. You get away with everything.
But is that an onus that the Rachmana had to patre? You know, did they have to give an excuse why it's okay? Or is it like Muvan May Love? You can't do it during the day? Yeah, go ahead, do it at night. I'm not here posking for anybody. I'm just saying that it would make sense to me that all of these are very important. They're part and parcel of the joy of Purim. And let's say you saw an Oni at night. And you matanot lev yonim. Yeah, you have to do another one during the day. I don't know. Or as Rav Herschel Schechter says, no. I don't know. But it's interesting opinions. Again, the Rush, daytime. The Rama, daytime. The Gra, daytime. And now to our question, if somebody can't deliver or arrange to have it delivered on Purim and sends it before, is he yotze with Mishloach Manot? One opinion says if it's delivered before Purim, it may be eaten before the Seuda, and you've not really accomplished the point of Mishloach Manot. That's if the point of Mishloach Manot is to enhance the Seuda. But others say the Mishloach Manot, the point of that is to engender friendliness and a sense of community, it arvut. So Mishloach Manot is not for one reason only. But if you hold it, the main reason is to enhance the Seuda. So you give it before, they may eat it, whatever, not a good idea. The Aruch HaShulchan, he says the netina, the giving, and the Kabbalah, the receiving of it, is done on Purim. That's the best way to do it. And if you give it to a shaliach before Purim to arrive on Purim, you're certainly yotze. But anything before Purim, says the Aruch HaShulchan, you have not fulfilled your obligation. Here's an interesting question that I touched on before. How often do you need to remember the nefarious deeds of Amalek? How often? So the Rambam says, Rambam, he says constantly, and he refers to a pasuk in Malachim, chapter 5, pasuk 5. It's a constant reminder. What does constant mean? Daily, weekly, monthly, as opposed to not at all. Monthly could be constant. But he says it's a ongoing. Let's call it ongoing. He seems to be not that precise from what I saw. The Sefer Achinuch says once a year, or maybe once in 2-3 years. So we're not talking about a heavy burden to remember Amalek. That's what the Sefer Achinuch says. Once a year, once in 2-3 years. Minchat Chinuch has us all falling from our chair by saying, even once in a lifetime fulfills the requirement of remembering Amalek and its nefarious deed. Once in a lifetime, according to Minchat Chinuch, the Shalah, he says it's a great mitzvah to say it every day. And those who read those six zichirot every day at the end of davening or some point during the day, you know that that's one of them. So that's what the Shalah says. Every day, that's how you fulfill the mitzvah. And here's what the Rebbe says. This is the previous Rebbe, who for some is the current Rebbe. The Rebbe says this. He says, Amalek's attack was calculated to shake Jewish belief in God and to dampen their enthusiasm for Torah and mitzvot. That's how he sees. Like if you were to say to somebody, we have to remember the nefarious deeds of Amalek. What was the kernel of their nefarious deeds? What's the most nefarious of their nefarious deed? In other words, what was the most terrible thing that they did besides decimate people and decimate Jews? So the Rebbe has distilled that for us by saying it was calculated to attack Jewish belief. Because, as I mentioned in the very beginning, when they came out of Mitzrayim, everybody was awed of the Jewish people. Nobody ever leaves the slavery of Egypt. They've come out. There must be a power higher than anything in the universe that has brought them out, has redeemed them. And they are untouchable. These Jews are hot. They are red hot. You can't touch them. And they deserve every respect and every fear. We need to fear and revere them because of the great redemption that they were given. So, according to the Rebbe, comes Amalek to show the world, no, they're not as red hot as you think. We're going to cool these people off, and we're going to decimate them and penetrate their, make them vulnerable. And that way it'll make them themselves and the Jewish people in the future question, hey, how much did Hashem protect them if he couldn't protect them from Amalek? That's what the Rebbe says. That's the kernel of what they did and why we keep reminding ourselves of this, of their nefarious deeds. So the Rebbe says Amalek did their evil out of pure hatred for the Jews. And Amalek remains intractable, incurable, unyielding in their hatred. As evidenced, I think much mentioned this one time, a YouTube clip of an Arab mother is lying near the bed of her Arab son, and who an Israeli doctor, this is in Israel somewhere, an Israeli doctor has done surgery that saved the life of her son. And somebody comes and interviews her and says, you know, tell us what happened, blah, blah, blah. And she said, the interviewer says something like, so how did you feel about Jews in general before this happened? She says, I hate them, always will hate them. This is not exactly the words, but this is the tenor of what she's saying. And then the interviewer says, now that an Israeli Jew has saved your son's life with this surgery that he just did, do you feel any different about the Jews? And she says, no, I have always hated them and will always hate them.
Well, this reminds me, if an Amalekite doctor had saved one of us, we might say the exact same thing.
She could have been, in my opinion, a little bit more generous and say, I don't hate this one.
He wouldn't have done it, so he didn't have he wouldn't have the case.
Oh,
no, so
right,
that
right.
is a real question. Also, I know we have a need to do this because there are a lot of anti-Semites in the world, and this is a good place to start. But I have a sense that these desert pirates, I mentioned this yesterday, they couldn't care whom they're attacking. They're just out there to get booty and pillaging and slave trade. They're just pirates on the sand. What do you call that? Sand jockeys. They could care less who they're attacking. And it happens that they bumped into us. Because, you know, and then they attack from the rear. They're like terrorists in the sense that they're not going after the men. They're going after the weakless and the sick and the women.
Infirm.
But I don't think they really cared exactly who it was. There's no evidence of that. And we had just come out of Egypt. I don't think anyone knew who we were, despite the fact that we think the world got like an email about our coming. Like everyone heard about the news.
Right.
There's no, you know, you go to China, go to India, go to Europe. I don't think the news was quite as extensive as it appears to us. So, but it's nice to use this because for pedagogic purposes, we need to hang a hat on something. And this is as good as any. Now, of course, they attacked us in the sense, in a very bad way, where we have a phrase, no fear of God. You know, Yosef tells the brothers, there's no Yirat Shamayim. We tell Avimelech, there's no Yirat Shamayim here. I think that's a euphemism for not complying with the rules of the game of that time, as opposed to really belief in a God. So these Amalekites are not playing by the rules of their time. And so they're just terrorists even then. But still, pirates are pirates. You know, when pirates go up to ships on the sea, they just take captives and they take booty. Sometimes they kill them, but usually it's for money. You know, and to put them all in this category like Nazis who had an agenda to wipe out Jews, that's clear. From Amalekites, I don't see this as their agenda necessarily. But it's a good way to use it as a basis to.
It's a rallying.
Yeah, it's a good way to rally the call because listen, the first people that attacked us, and I know this, they dunked us in a hot bath, taking the heat away, and you know, removing the fear of God in a way because we were known as God. The whole world knew we're God's people. So by attacking us, they weakened that connection somehow, and you know, stymied our own sense of self-esteem. Who knows what? But the bottom line is they attack the old, the sick, the infirm from the rear. A nasty way to do it.
Without necessarily hating Jews. You're
no,
saying
no,
this
no, they're just going for
generic booty. Destroyers.
Yeah, they're just
and they become our national pinata.
Exactly.
That's we were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
You might say that, but it would have attacked anybody.
No, I wouldn't say that.
All right, so
there are people in New York. You run out of gas in the wrong end of New York. They don't care who you are. You're in trouble. If someone mugs you, they don't care who you are. Either they want your money, they're going to take it. I mean, you're Jewish, not Jewish, you're this, you're that. You know, certain people, if you run, you're going to be the wrong place at the wrong time.
I hear what you're saying. It seems that others see it differently. And
well,
see it as
they're taking the color of their own content. Like today, it's easy to point to this Arab lady and say, wow, look at that intense hatred, which of course comes from the same religious source, so to speak, as our Amalekite comment. They view it as a religious thing. How else can you explain that? And we have our own religious thing. So would we find an Amalekite? An individual can't make this decree. It's from the government. A national mitzvah, even though Shaul's arm bearer was an Amalekite. I mean, he'll explain that. But that's my take on. But it's good to use it because we have to get ourselves up, and you got to hate the enemy. Jews don't know how to do that properly.
Okay, I think what you just said now was very valid. Not that the other stuff wasn't. This we don't know how to appropriately hate an enemy.
Well, some of us. It depends who you vote for.
All right. So I'll finish off by saying these two things. I hear you. I hear you. So the Rebbe said this is an intractable enemy, blah, blah, blah.
Just wait, one more thing. There's a midrash that says that Amalek is the grandson of Esau. You know, his father's Eliphaz. And who was a little Amalek, a little kid? He's looking at the burial of Yaakov, and he sees the story of Esau, his grandpa, blocking the path. And then he sees, I think it's Chumshin, whip out a sword and slice off the head of his grandpa, which rolls into the cave. An indelible PTSD case on little Amalek. And lo and behold, you have a hatred of these Israelites. I mean, so I'm the last liberal to, I'm not a liberal in the least, but I can imagine that scene of what the little grandkid would think about having a grandpa and how he'd forever raise his descendants to hate those people.
Okay. So he, at the same time, the Rebbe teaches that Amalek, this probably won't surprise us, represents a bigger picture, and Amalek represents, he says, all the obstacles a Jew encounters on their way to enriching their Jewish lives. Amalek represents all of the obstacles. He says that every Jew has been given the necessary powers to overcome our personal Amaleks as we're trying to be more emuna, more bitachon, etc. But these Amaleks keep coming in our way, and we need to mobilize our inner powers that were given in order to annihilate these personal Amaleks. Interesting. I'm going to take the last 2 minutes, David, if I may, just to share with you what Rabbi Soloveitchik said. He is so right on. I'll just read a piece of it. He says, a specific feature of the deed of Amalek, and this ties in a little bit, Bruce, to what you said. A specific feature of the deed of Amalek was that Bnei Israel had no land to defend. Amalek had no imperialistic rationale for fighting or attacking Amalek, for fighting or attacking. Amalek was also geographically distant from Egypt, so Bnei Israel, they didn't pose a geographical threat to them. Their motives appeared to be pure hatred. This is not what Bruce feels, but that's what Rav Soloveitchik says. He says they had no reason to display enmity, and defeating a weak and weary nation after the Exodus would have brought Amalek no acclaim. Like, who are these people? They have no land. They have no geography. They haven't. So to defeat this kind of poor, defenseless, etc., who's going to applaud Amalek for, oh, you vanquished the Soviet Union. Good for you. It's a people that is, it's who would give Amalek an award? And say, wow, they're the new world power because look what they did to the Jews. So he concludes by saying, our faith in man's goodness should not blind us to the latent demonic in man. Civilized men can become the personification of evil. Think of October 7th. The thin veneer of social restraint can suddenly be lifted. We've seen this last few months. Exposing the ugly, brutish potential in man. Created in the image of God, man can also assume a satanic identity. He is capable of going berserk, of turning into a monster.
You said civilized, but doesn't apply to the Arabs.
You're right, because they're so good.
Not a joke. They're not civilized.
They're not civilized.
No.
But I appreciate what he said about we have to be the thin veneer of social restraint. This is what everybody said. You can't say these things out loud. Can suddenly be lifted. Everybody says what's on their mind. All the pus comes out, exposing the ugly, brutish potential in humankind. I'm always awed by the way he phrases things. And anyway, there's a lot more to say. We'll have to leave it for next Purim. Thank you very much for joining us. Have an easy Tanit today.
Thank you.
And Freilich and Purim, a good and Shabbos. Be happy, healthy, and safe.
Thank you.
And God willing, we'll see you next Thursday.
Thank you very much.
All right. Enjoy.
Okay. Good morning, Rabbi David.